Okay, well, I must thank my friend Karen for organizing this venue once again. And I must say that many people have noticed that I come out with these books right on time. I didn't predict that the subprime meltdown would coincide with the release of my book. But I did predict that it was going to happen in chapter two, in fact. So I think I should possibly have invested some money on the stock exchange. I would be rich now. I've done it. So anyway, let me tell you that just briefly how the idea of writing this book came to me. It was actually last time when I was here in Washington promoting the book on insurgent Iraq and al-Zarqawi. And at that time, Freakonomics came out. So a friend said, you must read this because it's such a surreal interpretation of the economy. So I read the first chapter. And suddenly I realized that it was just one little section of what is happening in the world. And to a certain extent, having dealt with the economics of terrorism gave me a certain view of the global criminal and illegal economy, which was, in reality, a view of a world, of an economy completely out of control. So I decided that I was going to investigate this aspect of the economy. I mean, not necessarily the criminal economy or the terror economy, but this economy that has no rules. And I must say that the idea eventually to start researching this book seriously came after my youngest son forced me to watch The Matrix. I had refused it because in my mind it was one of those kids' film. Anyway, so eventually he forced me, and I watched The Matrix, and I just thought, my gosh, you know, this is exactly the answer, that in a globalized world, we run the risk to become numbers on a screen. And at the same time, we also run the risk to be trapped inside a web of illusions because it's very difficult to know exactly from where the products come from, you know, which are the true interdependencies of the economy. So I decided to put out a proposal for this book. And in my mind, there was that this book was going to analyze where global capitalism had gone wrong. So what were the failures, basically, in order to rectify this failure, or at least, you know, to identify this failure. I also thought that this was a phenomenon typical of our time, so to a certain extent, you know, a unique phenomenon, because we never had a true globalization before. And as I started my research, I completely changed my mind. So if this was a PhD dissertation, it would have been perfect because you start from an hypothesis and you end up, you know, to the opposite one. Mm-hmm. So, and the truth is that what I realize through this research, which is not only on the economy, but it is on all aspects of globalization because everything is interlinked. So I talk about culture, I talk about music, I also talk about politics, you know, social changes, is the fact that rogue economics is not a new phenomenon at all. I mean, it does happen at times of great transformation. I mean, it happened during the Industrial Revolution, for example. I mean, the foundation of Western capitalism were laid at the time in which the new industrialists of that time decided to exploit the poor and the weak. I mean, the work in the workhouses, everybody knows the books of Dickens, for example. So at times of great transformation, politics loses control of the economy because the economy moves much, much faster and politics can't keep pace with it. So it is at this time that rogue economics come out. And to a certain extent, rogue economics could be defined as a sort of force which is constantly lurking in the background of progress. And when it comes out, we have great leap forward. So progress, to a certain extent, it is very much linked to this phenomenon. And the Industrial Revolution, perhaps, is the latest of these examples. So we could define rogue economics as the price that we pay for great progress. So this was quite a shocking conclusion, I must say. But it was also positive, because that means that what is happening today is not at all the end of our world, the end of Western, well, probably it is the end of Western supremacy, but you know, a new economy, new forces will come out, and eventually we'll find a new equilibrium. Now, we are right in the middle of this process, and everything is new. The fundamentals of economics do not work anymore, because we are in completely new territory. But that doesn't mean the economics will cease to exist, or it doesn't mean that politics eventually will not take over economics once again. So, I mean, this basically was the conclusion of my research. And let me explain what Rogue really is. The decision to call this book Rogue was actually not easy, because I didn't really know how to describe a phenomenon that has always been with us, but perhaps has not been identified as such. So Rogue is, to a certain extent, an umbrella under which we do find the criminal economy, the illegal economy, and for sure also the terror economy. But in particular, we find these gray areas where there is no regulation, where there is no proper legislation, which are formed by this new economy that is moving so fast. And I want to give you, just to explain what I mean, I want to give you the example of the Russian oligarchs. Now, but before doing that, let me just tell you that just to summarize, to a certain extent, what are the components of this, you know, rogue economics. So there are three, basically. One is the proliferation of these gray areas. And this is where rogue entrepreneurs can blossom. So individuals that take the advantages of major, major changes into the economy. But also, at the same time, we see that this kind of entrepreneur creates new, surreal, almost, economic interdependencies. The second element is the transition from the nation state to the market state. Now, this has been analyzed very well by Philip Bobbitt in his book, The Shield of Achilles. And it is fundamental, because this explains why politics actually is losing control of the economy. And then the third element is what I define the market matrix. So this is this web of commercial, economic, political illusions that alters consumers' and voters' perception of reality. So to understand what I mean for gray areas, but also for surreal economic interdependencies, the book starts with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the creation of the Russian oligarchs. Now, we all know that the Russian oligarchs became immensely rich because they stripped the wealth, the national wealth of Russia. About, you know, $400 billion moved out of Russia in the space of very few years. What we really don't understand very well is how this happened. So I did, at the time, actually, when 1989, I was actually working for the National Bank of Hungary, and I work on the convertibility of the Hungarian forint, which then became the blueprint of the convertibility of the ruble. So I start looking at the convertibility of the ruble, because I thought, you know, the major change that the former Soviet Union had to undergo was the monetarization, difficult word to pronounce, the monetarization of the economy. Now, centrally planned economies do not have currencies as we do. They have currencies that are not convertible outside their economy. So in the case of the Soviet Union, but also in the case of the Soviet bloc, there were two types of currencies. In the Soviet Union, there was the convertible ruble and the non-convertible ruble. Now, the non-convertible ruble was what was used in all commercial transactions, but also in imports and exports within the Soviet bloc. The convertible ruble, which, of course, was convertible only inside the Soviet bloc, was used primarily in the black market. Now, the black market was very important, because on the black market you could find all the products, of course you couldn't find in the official market, but also it was a sort of cushion for when shortages took place. I mean, centrally planned economy were constantly plagued by shortages of products. So the authority let the black market thrive. It was accepted. Now, when the wall came down, the IMF was called in into the Soviet Union in order to help the transition of a centrally planned economy to a market economy. And one of the problems was, how are we going to transform all of these non-convertible rubles into convertible rubles? And then from there, how are we going to convert the currency? Now, converting the currency was not such a big deal. The real problem was how to convert the non-convertible into convertible. Now, about 70 to 80% of the economy was based upon non-convertible rubles. Now, in a centrally planned economy, there is no treasury. So the Russian did not have a treasury. Now, if they had had a treasury, of course, you know, the treasury could have taken over that task. At the same time, of course, the central bank could not do the conversion because there were not enough rubles in circulation. So either was printing convertible rubles, which means inflating the economy, or find a way to convert progressively through economic growth the non-convertible into convertible. So Gorbachev had this great idea. He thought that the best way was to give the youth clubs of communists in the universities that task. They were allowed to convert non-convertible rubles into convertible rubles. And they were allowed through a series of initiatives which were considered scientific. Now, the most popular initiative... all university at the Youth Communist Club.
Oh, the Youth Communist Club.
So the Youth Communist Club was basically the, let's say, the offspring of the party. You had to be a member of the party in order to be part of it. So this initiative were defined scientific initiative. But the most popular initiative that were organized were pop concert and beauty contest. So the story of Khodorkovsky is perhaps the best example of the creation of an oligarch through this kind of activity. Now, Khodorkovsky was the president of the Youth Communist Club of Moscow University. He was a very clever man. So the way he organized these many schemes in order, you know, to make money out of this privilege that he was given is the following. So the youth club would organize a beauty contest or a pop concert. People would go and pay with non-convertible rubles. The non-convertible rubles were then taken by Khodorkovsky and they were exchanged for art currencies with exports of timber from Russia. Now, the timber exports had a lot of foreign currencies because, of course, they were exporting. And they really didn't know what to do because they couldn't use it inside the economy. So he gave the non-convertible rubles. He got the foreign cash, the foreign currencies. He used the foreign currency to buy computers in the West. He imported the computers into the Soviet Union and sold it for non-convertible rubles. And so the scheme goes on. And each time he did one of those operations, he was pocketing huge profits. Now, as this process went on, of course, the non-convertible rubles, you know, started flowing inside, you know, the central bank. So the central bank would then, you know, convert them. But this was a process that went on through a long time. Now, the interesting thing, actually the shocking thing, I would say, is the interdependency created between this kind of process and the Russian mafia, which started in booming business in exporting prostitutes and sex slaves into Western Europe. Now, from 89 through the 90, the sex industry in the West was booming because of that. Now, that is linked to the fact that the dismantling of communism had completely destroyed the communist economy. So in that, the people that were particularly hit were women. Women because they were employed in certain sectors that suffered the most because of the transition. Now, women unemployment went from virtually zero before 89 to 80% in the mid-1990s. Now, women were left behind to look after the children. Men emigrated to the West, but women also were left with the families, so, you know, the grandparents, and they started to look for any possible kind of job. Now, the way the mafia lured these women into prostitution was actually at the beauty contest. At the beauty contest, women would go. They would be promised jobs in the West. Some of them, you know, of course, you know, the most beautiful, they were even promised, you know, an entry tickets to Hollywood. Then they would be given a ticket to go to the West. And as soon as, you know, they landed in the West, they were forced into prostitution or sex slavery. Now, the figures are shocking. They're absolutely shocking. But also, the interesting thing, and this is all the interlinking of the economy, the politics, and also the culture, prices of prostitute services in the West start, you know, dropping because, you know, the supply was so large. I mean, I interviewed people in Berlin that run some of these sex bars, for example, and they told me that through the 90s, they were making easily, you know, between 5,000 and 10,000 euros per day running this kind of businesses. Now, this was all controlled by the Russian mafia. Now, of course, Khodorkovsky was not in business with the Russian mafia. He didn't get a cut out of this business. But, of course, Khodorkovsky created the condition, the ideal condition for the Russian mafia to profit from this business. Now, that, I think, is one a good example of this rogue economics. Now, at the same time, Khodorkovsky didn't break any law, because there were no laws. I mean, the fact that actually he set up schemes through which he profited from the conversion of non-convertible ruble into rubles, it was not illegal. He was doing exactly what he wanted to do, and there was not a legislation that prevented that. Now, had Russia, of course, had the treasury would have handled that kind of business. So this is how Khodorkovsky and many others like him started to accumulate a wealth that then they used later on to blackmail Yeltsin and to basically pocket also the money that the IMF sent after the ruble crisis into the former Soviet Union. But this is a good example of, you know, rogue economics. Now, the other interesting thing is that I looked at a correlation between the spreading of democracy after the Berlin Wall. Now, the reason why I decided to start from the Berlin Wall is because before the Berlin Wall is because I'm convinced that this is when globalization really started. I mean, until then, we did have a movement within the economy, in particular with Reaganomics and also Mrs. Thatcher, to deregulate the markets, to open up the markets. But it was always limited to half of the world. I mean, the moment in which the wall came down, then Western capitalism really could expand globally. I mean, the world, to a certain extent, became its oyster. Now, before that, that could not have happened. So I looked at the correlation between the spreading of democracy and the increase in slavery. And this is another amazing interdependency. Now, these two move in the same direction, and there is a very, very strong correlation. Now, the number of democratic countries went from 63 before 1989 to 118 in the mid-1990s, at the same time slavery start rising. And he writes in particular in those countries which have benefited from the transition to democracy. Now, the sex slaves from the former Soviet Union is just one of the many examples. Now, figures from the ILO, the International Labour Organization, confirm this correlation, and the latest figure that we have is for the late 1990s, which is 27 million people. This is the official figure. Now, of course,
for sex slaves?
No, for slavery in general.
What do you mean by slavery? Like in Sudan?
Slavery is defined exactly as was slavery in this country. It's people who are deprived totally of their freedom. They are enslaved. They are given enough to survive, so they're fed, basically. But these are people deprived totally of their freedom. I know it's quite shocking because, you know, in fact, the ILO does have a proper definition in its report. Because often when people think slavery, they think slave labor. This is not slave labor.
This is trafficked against their... trafficked into situations and stuff.
It could be Chinese restaurant workers right. In the U.S. It could be Philippine maids, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. This is slave labor. This is children trekking from Mali to the Ivory Coast to go and work in the cocoa plantation, who get there to get a job, and they get locked inside the plantation, and they are enslaved. Exactly as it was slavery in the U.S. At the time of, you know, the transatlantic trade, there is massive trafficking. I can give you other example. For example, Chinese workers who buy their passage through a trafficker from China to France. France is the most important market actually for Chinese slaves. They get there, they are deprived, or they traveling documentation. The traveling documentation is sent back to China, so it looks like, you know, they actually have come back, and they are enslaved. They work in sweatshops for the garment industry. There are slaves of the fish pirates, for example, people that are offered a job on a boat to go fishing, were then left in the middle of the ocean in little boats, and the different ships come. These are, you know, huge ships that basically, you know, do poaching mostly, and they're picked up each time, and then they're put back there. I mean, the story is endless. It's quite shocking, actually. It's really... but all of this is all of this documentation is from the ILO is available, of course, you know, online, and you can read the stories. But a lot of this also is documented by other organizations, NGOs. I mean, Greenpeace, for example, Oxfam. Anyway, I think this was quite, for me at least, was quite shocking. But the other interesting thing about slavery and democracy is that during the process of decolonization in the 1950s, we also saw an increase in slavery in the countries that gained independence. So people were enslaved by their own countrymen. So it is not necessarily a rogue economics phenomenon. It is a phenomenon linked to transition. Let me now talk a little bit about the market state. This is the second element of rogue economics. Now, Philip Bobbitt described the market state as a state that is replacing progressively the nation state. I mean, the nation state is a state that basically pursues the interests of the community, of the members of the state. So people decide to renounce some of their liberties in exchange of protection from the state. And this is the state that emerged from the Industrial Revolution. Now, today, we see a transition towards a state that doesn't any longer pursue this kind of interest, but that provides for the individual, so not for the collectivity, but for the individual, the best economic conditions in order to thrive, in order to grow economically. Now, this clearly, it is a state that allows deregularization, that pursues deregularization. And we see the rise of these states in particular after the fall of the Berlin Wall. What's happened at that time was that the supply of labor in the West started rising because, of course, you know, people from the former communist countries were able to offer their work in the West. And in fact, the supply of labor doubled in the space of very few years. Now, that creates a series of economic circumstances. One is, of course, the fall in the cost of labor. At the same time, you know, we saw a deregularization policy carried out by the Fed, which was sustained by a deflation. So interest rates start coming down, and they come down quite rapidly. So that means also that the cost of capital is going down. Now, this phenomenon created a high return on capital. So there was wealth, which was created in the West. But this wealth was not redistributed in the way it had been redistributed in the past. So what we see happening is a widening of the gap between the middle class and the rich class, which become richer and richer. We see that most of the benefits of this change go to a percentage of the population which is less than 1%. So we see the advent of income inequality. So we have won the Cold War. We are spreading democracy to the rest of the world. But at home, we're actually pursuing income inequality. Now, the figures are quite, surprising. Now, if you look at the median income of the American population, so the median income is the one that is sandwiched between, you know, the rich and the poor. Today, the median income, it is lower in real terms, so net of inflation, than what it was in the early 1970s. So there is a progressive impoverishment of the middle class, which is the backbone of our democracies. Now, that is caused by a series of circumstances. In particular, I could mention, you know, the fiscal policy that has been pursued by all the administrations since 1989, which is a fiscal policy whereby, you know, you reduce taxation on, you know, the higher levels of the earners, because the trickle-down effect will bring this wealth down near to the middle classes. Now, that has not been the case. Now, the other interesting thing is that this small percentage of the population is accumulating vast wealth also thanks to globalization. And this I refer to individuals who perceive incomes which are absolutely astronomical. And this goes from, you know, great sportsmen like Tiger Woods to actors like Julia Roberts, for example, or, you know, even to the CEO of large Wall Street companies. At the same time, people that work within those industries, so from the guy that cuts the grass, you know, at the golf course, to the manager of the cinema, and to the middle management of the Wall Street firm, are actually, in real terms, getting poorer and poorer. And if you look at middle management, real income in finance, and compare it with the CEO, there also we see the widening of the gap. Now, just to give you a very brief image of what I'm talking about, there is in the book a section where I refer to a Dutch statistician who has produced the so-called income parade. So what he did, he basically gave to the different segments of the population and height, which correspond to their income. And then it showed how these people would march. So you start from people who are below the poverty line, which are probably 30 centimeter, 40 centimeter high. And then for a long time, you know, you see people rising progressively until you get to the middle class, so the medium income, which, for example, would be 170, 1 meter 70, centimeters. And then suddenly from that level, you go to people who are 300 meters, 400 meters, up to 3 kilometers high. And it's very sudden. So that gives you as an image the degree of this income inequality. Now, the last... actually, no, I want to mention something also about the regulation. The withdrawal of the state from the position of a nation state to a market state is also at the root of what is happening today, you know, with the crisis of the subprime. And I think a very good example is what's happened to Carlyle Capital just, you know, 10 days ago. Now, the subprime bubble was created by lack of regulation. Again, nobody did anything illegal. But the truth is that the consequences are tragic. So we have a debt, a growing debt, which is transformed through derivatives into an asset. And as we have falling interest rate combined with rising prices of property due to the fact that this falling interest rate are encouraging people to buy more and more, even beyond their means, these assets start having a value, which is an increasing value. So we have banks, financial institutions start borrowing in order to get part of this asset. Now, the story of Carlyle Capital is very interesting because, you know, when Carlyle Capital finally collapsed, the ratio of assets to debt was 1 to 33. That means that for each dollar in their assets, they actually borrowed $33. And the way they were allowed to do that is because they bought mortgage-backed securities today. The interest rate dropped tomorrow. The price of property went up again, and the value of those mortgage-backed securities went up. But it's all on paper. And so they borrowed against that increased value, and they kept borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. The largest lender of Carlyle Capital was Bear Stearns. So when Carlyle Capital collapsed, Bear Stearns collapsed. Now, it didn't collapse necessarily because of the debt. It collapsed because of the fiduciary crisis of all the other people, all the other banks who had lent to Bear Stearns. So potentially what it could happen is disastrous because everybody's interlinked. Now, nobody has broken any law, but there was no law. So now we have the Fed pumping $30 billion into the economy every week in order to save...
One point I would mention is that part of the problem why even the rating agencies could not rate these financial institutions properly is the problem of translating the market value to the book value.
Yes.
Because the instruments were so complicated, the financial derivatives.
The derivatives, yeah.
Yeah, it's extremely complicated. So it's not easy to... They have no idea how to translate the market value to the book value. How much do they really work on the books? So this is the problem that is, in all honesty, I think that we'll have to grapple with for the foreseeable future.
But this is a very good point. This is exactly the point. I mean, nobody knows how big the bubble is because of derivatives. Now, derivatives are not regulated. Now, there is a regulation about interest rate, but there is no regulation about derivatives. So you can take an interest rate and transform it into whatever you want through derivatives. It's all a mathematical exercise, which of course produces on paper, you know, wealth, but in reality, it is no wealth. So
the other point I would mention here, I buy all your points, the points that you make that, you know, the inequality has increased and all that. I don't have a problem with that. But I think we need to be aware of the fact that inequality and poverty are extremely difficult concepts to measure on a worldwide scale. Part of the problem is that both the time series and cross-sectional sense, it's a very hard concept. For example, poverty. What is poverty in India is different from what is poverty in sub-Saharan Africa and what is poverty in the United States. Because the purchasing power parity problem, that is a basket of goods in India is a poor man's basket, is not the same basket of goods in sub-Saharan Africa or the United States. So to measure poverty across the world is a very difficult technical exercise. That's one in a cross-sectional, that's the problem. And the time series problem is that the problem of inflation adjustment of poverty levels over time is also another problem. How do you adjust for inflation? So this problem of this, I mean, a lot of people will sympathize with you when you say that inequality has increased and middle class is under pressure. But I would like to just say that different measures of inequality give a slightly different picture. It's not an absolute kind of thing.
Go ahead. Let's just finish a few more minutes of this, and then we can open the floor to discussion.
Maybe I didn't mention it, but I'm referring only to Western countries. So I didn't. This income parade only refers to industrialized countries. So the other element of rogue economics is this market matrix. Now the market matrix is particularly important because this is what traps consumers. We really don't know what we're consuming, and I just want to give you an example. Now, this is an example about gold. Now, you know the gold prices have gone up tremendously recently. Now, at 950 per ounce, which happened mid-January, the demand for jewelry from jewelers stopped. This is when, basically, they couldn't afford to buy them anymore. At that point, the demand for gold on the black market start rising because, of course, gold from the black market is much cheaper. Now, the United Nations issued a warning to Wall Street and to the world, saying that if gold prices were continuing to go so high, number one, the demand was going to be limited only to speculation, which today is probably 70%, and the real demand for gold, which is for industrial usage and also for jewelry, was going to be diverted completely to the black market. And the reason why the UN did this is because the UN has been particularly concerned with gold coming out from Congo. Now, Congo is a country that has a sanction against the arms trade because, of course, it's a country basically ruled by warlords. The warlords control the Ituri region, which is the region where all the mines are. Now, Congo is one of the largest producers of gold in the world. Now, we know that this gold is smuggled through Uganda and is sold from Uganda into the global market. Now, Uganda has never exported gold until the early 1990s when the gold market was deregulated in Uganda. So what the UN was saying, watch out, because what we're doing by pushing these prices so high is actually giving even more incentive to this kind of business. On top of that, we're giving the warlords a higher return. And I think that's very interesting because we have seen a lot written, and also we saw that film about blood diamonds. But the truth is that the diamond trade is much more controllable and regulated because diamonds are controlled by a cartel. So although the black market does exist, it's much harder for blood diamonds to enter the global market, while gold is totally deregulated. It's a free market. So the market matrix, to a certain extent, shows us that we can go and buy a ring or earrings or a present for somebody in gold, and that gold not only feeds the warlords of Congo, but it's being produced by people enslaved in the mines of Ituri. So that's one of the interdependencies that I think we have to become conscious about. So To conclude, I do not think, although I told you terrible things, that this is going to last forever. This is not the end of our world, or clearly not the breaking down of the Western economic system. But it is a transition, and there are positive things which are happening even during rogue economics. And just to give you some ideas, for the first time now, we know that the African growers of corn are going to be allowed to export to the West, because corn prices are skyrocketing, partly because a large percentage of corn production is now going to biofuel. And therefore, our tariffs, because we always had these huge tariffs to protect our agriculture against continents like Africa, our tariffs are now coming down, because we need that corn. So this is beneficial for Africa for sure. Think about China, for example. 15 years ago, the largest percentage of the Chinese population was starving. Today, China is not only feeding itself, but is growing. And then there's another aspect which maybe we can discuss in the discussion, which is the rising power of Islamic finance. Now, Islamic finance is the fastest growing sector of international finance, and it is the only sector which is not linked to the subprime. They did not subscribe any of the mortgage-backed securities, because it is unacceptable under the Sharia law to invest in products linked to interest rate. So even if we have a meltdown in the West, it's not going to be like 1929, because there is a sector, international finance, which is going to survive. We will always be able to bank in an Islamic bank. Think about this. This is positive.
All right, well, thank you very much, Loretta, for a really fascinating tour of some very scary issues. I should have added earlier, Loretta is obviously a trained economist, but has been doing research on terrorism and the dark side for many, many years. She was one of the first people to interview the Red Brigades in Italy. So she has spent a lot of time looking at the black markets of the world. So we could almost call her a rogue researcher.
Yeah, a rogue researcher.
But let me open up the floor. I'm sure it stimulated some good questions here. And maybe Rick, please.
I'm not going to start, but maybe pick up on a couple of things that you said near the end in particular. Sort of the stability of the Islamic banks that you described. How much are they likely to be losing their stability by investing fairly significant amounts in bailing out our banks?
That's a very good question.
Are they doing somewhat what the Japanese did when they invested and bought all of our real estate at its most inflated point, and then watched their investments deflate for a period of years? And that would be one question. And then I guess my bigger question is, you sort of suggest that from each of these periods that something new will emerge, and that there is an equilibrium that we'll find. And I didn't quite get what that's going to look like. What do you think that new equilibrium is going to look like? Maybe you could clarify that.
Well, it's very interesting what you said about the Islamic finance. Now, the UBS recent writing off of $19 billion subprime is a very good example of how these Islamic funds are actually backing off, bailing out our banks. Because UBS, at the last quarter of 2007, at $12.5 billion of bad debt because of the subprime. So it got an injection of cash from a sovereign fund in Saudi Arabia and one in Singapore. Now, this time, they didn't. Now, they did try, but they didn't. They went back, and they couldn't get it. Now, the reason why this is happening is because the subprime crisis hitting the AAA mortgage-backed security. So basically, it's hitting those good mortgages, mortgages that people are repaying. So there is a very strong reluctance from Islamic money to bail out.
I think there's a recognition on their part that maybe the first round of investing wasn't so smart.
Well, yes. I think, yes.
They put up $10 billion or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Now they're thinking, yeah, that wasn't such a good idea. Or do you think that's more, they can afford $10 billion anyway, so we care.
Yeah, I mean, look, yeah, the Kuwaiti fund is $900 billion, yeah. The sovereign fund. Now, these sovereign funds are actually independent from reserves. I mean, they are managed by the government, but they're independent for reserves. So 10 billion is nothing for them. But I think there is concern that they will invest this money, that this kind of help is not going to be enough to prevent the crisis. So they don't want to be involved in the crisis. That's a good sign of the crisis of confidence that is now hitting the entire world.
Of course, the $900 billion isn't just sitting in cash or gold or diamonds. The $900 billion is sitting in markets all over the world. So if the markets start to collapse, the $900 billion has a chance.
It's mostly sitting in Islamic Stock Exchange. The Saudi Arabian Stock Exchange has been the best performing stock exchange since 2004 in the world.
Yeah.
Iran Stock Exchange.
So
I mean, it's they're
global markets crash, they don't get hurt.
Well, they will. I mean, yes, of course, they will get hurt, but they will get hurt very less. Now, Malaysia doesn't have one single penny invested in any Western products, for example. Malaysia and
Indonesia
also. These are, you know, the big Islamic. Saudi Arabia has a lot of banks which are not 100% Islamic, but Malaysia is totally Islamic, so is Indonesia. So, and the other thing is China. China did buy 10% of Blackwater, I think it was 8 or 9 months ago. But now China is not touching the hedge funds. So I don't think these people will bail out. I do think that they have enough liquidity to save us. But I think we need government intervention. I think we need our governments to convince those guys to help us. But it's not going to happen. Yeah. But it's not going to happen. Can you imagine Western governments going and ask Chinese governments? It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Now, the other thing about this new equilibrium, this is actually the end of the book. I didn't want to give it away. No, but that's okay. No, I think what is going to happen is that the epicenter of the economic, but also the political world is shifting eastwards, and that's something that happened before. Now, before the Industrial Revolution, 75% of the world GDP was produced in India and China. And of course, this country did not take the advantages of that because of colonization or because of economic backwardness. But these countries do have the wealth. And as they are now modernizing, industrializing, they will be economic giants, definitely. And then we have this element of Islamic finance, which is fundamental because it is growing, is extremely flexible, because you can produce any kind of product. It's much more flexible than Western finance, because as long as you comply with the Sharia, you can do anything, basically. So I think there will be, in the long run, a new equilibrium whereby we'll see the economy, the economic model of countries like China and India, and the financial model of Islam merging. And this is going to be, I say, the new world. And within that, of course, we will have an increase in wealth, also income redistribution inside those areas, and eventually people will ask for more democratic forms of governance. So the same process that we have experienced in the West.
But those are capitalist models. So they're capitalist, not terribly regulated models that will have some indigenous qualities to them. But they're not radically
Yeah, well, they are very deregulated in terms of economics, but they're very regulated in terms of politics, and that's the key, basically. I mean, we have seen when there was the scandal, for example, of the fake medicine, which hit the U.S. The Chinese officers who was responsible for the region where the fake he was executed.
Mark, did you have a question?
Yeah, I mean, can you just explain some of the more fundamental differences between the Islamic financial system that you're talking about and the Western system? I mean, I guess I had the impression that, okay, you're not allowed to charge interest, but they just use these gimmicks to basically charge interest, but say it's not. So I'm just wondering, you know, what are the, you know, what's really different about it?
Yes, of course, you know, banks are banks. So, you know, they will work through the multiplier. You can't escape that. But it is the relationship between the client and the bank, which is fundamentally very different. So, for example, a mortgage. In a mortgage, you have a partnership between the bank who buys the property and the client for whom the bank buys the property. Because you can't use interest rate, the bank will charge you a cost for this type of service. And that cost will be incorporated into the value of the property. But then you start repaying the principals and the cost simultaneously. While here, of course, you pay the interest before. So it's the compounded interest of your mortgage is paid before. So you spend the first 3 or 4 years repaying the interest. The bank remains the owner of the property totally until you start repaying the principal. There is an incentive, and this is the subprime crisis also, the beginning. There is an incentive to a certain extent for the bank to lend to people who probably will not make it in repaying because it maintains the property. And there have been a lot of huge scandals taking place, especially in Colorado, in Montana, whereby banks use brokers in order to sell mortgages that they knew very well the individuals could not repay, and then they repossessed the property and sold over the property several times to other clients. So that kind of something like this would never happen in Islamic finance because money is not allowed to generate money. So you have to invest in the real economy. I know it is semantic to a certain extent, but it is important because it's a code of ethics built in the financial system. And the reason why we are in this crisis is because we did not have a code of ethics. We didn't break any law again, but there is a code of ethics. And in terms of financial products, financial products, basically, they have to respect the Sharia. So you can't invest in tobacco industry, prostitution, pornography, alcohol, and so on and so forth. But you can have any type of product you want. So we have this sukuk, which are the bonds. So you want to, let's say, you know, you want to build a library in your neighborhood, you can issue sukuk and then gather the money. And then finally, the third thing, which I think is fundamental, is microcredit. Microcredit is a creation of Islamic finance. We don't have microcredit. And microcredit is doing marvels in countries which are very, very poor, like Bangladesh.
Okay.
I don't know the point you mentioned, and I'm not sure what exactly you're trying to say about this. You know, I agree that China and India are rising economic powers, but I didn't get the bit about this merging of Islamic finance with this. I didn't understand what that means.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to mention is that this rising power is a bit overdone, I think. Every time I visit India, that this rising power is going to take at least minimum 100 years. I mean, nobody in this room will be here. I tell you, this is really done hyperbole. That's my basic, my honest opinion. I mean, I hope they, I'm sure, I come from India myself, and I hope that, of course, they improve their lot. but it's going to take a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Because the per capita income of India right now is like 1,200 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
United States per capita income is $45,000-$50,000. So
42.
You know,
yeah.
How long will it take for $1,200 to catch up with $50,000? God knows. Okay, that's one point.
Mm-hmm.
And the second point is this merging business. I don't understand. What, can you please tell me what it is? I mean, like, so that I can understand.
Which
this
one?
Merging of economic power of India and China with Islam.
Oh, merging. Yes, 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 yes. Well, we see that countries like India and in particular China, actually, more than India, are countries which economically have developed very quickly within the real economy. So there is a very high degree of sophistication in their industrialization. We do not have an identical degree of sophistication into the financial markets. Those are financial markets that are lagging behind the international financial markets, in particular Western markets. Where we see the opposite, where we actually see a high degree of sophistication in the financial markets, it is actually in Arab countries, and in particular in countries which have developed Islamic finance, and Malaysia being one of the most important, but also Saudi Arabia and Iran. I mean, the Iranian stock market has been performing fantastically well throughout the 2000s. This is why I said emerging, meaning there will be a point in which the high degree of sophistication of the Chinese and to a certain sense also the Indian economy will need a financial vehicle in order to continue to grow. And that financial vehicle is not going to be Western finance, it's going to be Islamic finance, because it's more flexible, but also it's more, the merge is to a certain extent more suited. There is always a tendency to look with suspicion in these countries to Western finance. And if things carry on as we are, there won't be any Western finance anyway.
The point I was trying to make was, I didn't make it that category, there's a lot of suspicion about Islamic finance in India too. I don't think
not in China.
To accept laws and all this.
Well,
I don't think this is, I mean, this is a bit of a hyperbole, I think, again.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think when we talk money, the Indians and the Chinese talk money as we do. Everybody. I don't think there is that degree of suspicion about Islamic finance. I think it is, to a certain extent, also a myth that we are all suspicious. I mean, we have all Western banks rushing to be part of Islamic finance. UBS has a huge sector of the bank, which only deals with Islamic finance, Deutsche Bank, all these banks. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't have got, you know, the help that they got before. No, I don't think so. I think people are suspicious because of the stigma attached to Islam in general.
And Sharia.
And Sharia, absolutely. But no,
I don't think democratic India is going to, and secular India is going to conform to Sharia laws. Absolutely no way.
But it's not the Sharia law in your life. It's the Sharia law in finance. This is the difference. People say Sharia law and think that, you know, in order to buy a bank account, I have to wear a veil. No, absolutely not. You can open. I could remortgage my house today in London through an Islamic bank in London. I would pay less interest and I would have better securities. And, you know, they would give it to me, no problem. And I walk into the bank as I am. So Sharia law is one thing. Sharia in finance is another thing. And we got to distinguish.
Okay, let me go back to the...
Sorry.
Just like a statistic. Like what? How big of a chunk is Islamic finance now in terms of the total global finance pie?
At the end of the first half of 2007 was $3 trillion.
A percent.
In percent, I think it would be between 10% and 15%.
Okay, so let me go three now, Victor, and then Anna, and then you. Right, okay.
I'll start my question with the name BCCI.
Oh yeah, yeah. Victor knows everything about BCCI.
Islamic financing gone wild? And don't we still have that same problem of the non-regulation of Islamic financing that creates the possibilities of many more ECCIs as this process continues? Tie that with the fact that there is a significant flow of capital because of oil prices and other commodity prices to the Islamic areas, which is not absorbed in those areas and which is made available then to be put into this banking system for export. Doesn't those factors alone create the same kinds of concerns multiple compared to the concerns that we've had and we've seen with the subprime and the non-regulation of the Western bank system? Aren't we at the cusp of what could be an even greater problem within Islamic banking?
Well, I mean, the BCCI, you're right about BCCI. It was an Islamic bank, of course. But the reason why it was a true, not only rogue, but criminal organization is also because it was in business with Western people who wanted to profit from that. So it was the mix. It was not the Islamic. It was the first and the most important developing bank also in the world. So it went bad also because of us, not only for them. But you're right. I think there is not a regulation in place for Islamic finance not to go rogue also. However, what I say is that we are going through this transition. Let's say, you know, we are in the middle of the tunnel and we're not seeing the light. One of the possible way in which we could get out, it is through Islamic finance. Now, will Islamic finance be better regulated? We have to see. I mean, we have to get to the point in which, you know, it grows to a level in which people in those countries, not in our countries, will demand regulations. And that's the same phenomenon that is happening here with us. I mean, why don't we have regulation? Because we were happy not to have it, because we were told that deregulation was great, and to a certain extent it was. Now we do need regulation. So that's, again, economics not being in control, but not being controlled by politics. I can't answer that question. But there is no alternative. There is the only place in the world where there is liquidity, the only sector of international finance that is not going to be hit by the crisis is that. I don't see any other alternative.
Let's hope so. Let's go to Anne, who's investing CSIS funds to try to make us some money. She's looking for new avenues to.
These are some observations, and I kind of wanted to bring some of this home to our member staff, because what Laura is talking about, a lot of people are very disconnected from money. Take a look over your left shoulder at the gentleman in the dark red glasses on the trustee wall. Uh-huh. Do you recognize him?
Rubenstein.
He's had Carlisle Capital.
Yes. Barron's Bank went bust because of a rogue trader. Nielsen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're right.
And it's just roll. It's like they're just rolling the dice. Mm-hmm. Some places it's going to pay the bill. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, after a really
sweet deal in the sense of what the 2.5% interest is our base.
We're building a building here at CSA. We're building it down the street.
All right.
So we're borrowing $100 million building.
It's a good time to build something. It's a great time to build. Yeah, absolutely. Labor is down. Your cost is down. It's, yeah.
You know, so people are looking for work. So when we start building in a year and a half, you know, it's really playing to our advantage. But, you know, we locked in our loan with the bank back in December at LIBOR plus 19 basis points.
Right.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Since that time, LIBOR has come down almost a full point. So now we have been modeling our rates at 4.5%. We're at 3.2.
So who lend you the money is making money.
PNC Bank, and they even said...
Because this is how they do it.
And if we were to go to the bank today, we would not be able to get LIBOR plus 19. We'd be looking at LIBOR plus 90. So we were in a perfect place at a perfect time. We were just, we really got lucky. You know, sometimes it's better to be lucky than smart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was luck. But, you know, economics shouldn't be based on luck.
No.
I guess my question is that like the Sharia Islamic finance, it's just like, it's basically just a different kind of finance under like a different name, something called Sharia that we wouldn't really like have like the stigma towards it. But I guess the question I have is that if they're providing a better deal and people are taking loans for them, the very nature of like our finance that it's adaptable, and I guess since it's ostensibly clothed in like religious framework, it's really, really hard to adapt that if, like, once, like, Western finance starts, like, competing with it more, and it really starts to have to go in and go to blows, I guess, with it, if that makes any sense.
What do you mean Western finance is competing?
Well, I guess if you're saying, like, Islamic finance is going to start going with the rest of the world and start financing because, you know, they have, like, different rules that can provide, like, better deals, I guess. Western finance, the virtue of it is that it would be able to, like, adapt itself, be able to compete with that.
I don't think so.
Being clothed in like that framework just wouldn't be able to.
It's rigid.
Yeah, it wouldn't be able to have like that same kind of, you know, adaptability, I guess.
Western finance. Well, for example, these community banks that give mortgages based more or less on the same principles of the Sharia, where you do not have this compounded interest rate. I mean, it is a more, I would say, equitable way of lending money. We do have these possibilities, absolutely. But I don't think that Western finance, what the Western finance is doing is trying desperately to get into Islamic finance, because there are 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, and they're growing very fast. So it is the Western finance which is trying to adapt to, you know, Islamic finance by becoming Islamic. Because if you look at UBS, for example, I mean, UBS is employing the same consultants that the Malaysian are employing in order to decide if a product is Sharia compliant or not. There is a handful of people in the world who actually do this job. They're immensely rich, of course, these individuals. But these are on the board of all of these different banks. So it's not the UBS is using its London office in order to produce this product. It needs to have the approval of those guys. And that, to me, makes UBS becoming Islamic, not, you know, competing or not, you know, providing. Because otherwise, you're not going to get a product. You got to have the approval of those committees, and those committees are Sharia compliance committees.
Okay, we have three questions in a row. Can you handle all three? Let's get them all on the table. So go ahead, please, and then come
in. In the first part of your talk, you discussed how political transition can create this atmosphere where the real economics can come out. Is there any way that we can shape those transitions from Washington or New York or London? You know, say, you know, there's a major political transition in Zimbabwe this week, or in North Korea.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we can do from here or advise them in some particular way?
Please.
And you mentioned how the prices of prostitution dropped drastically without a legal framework to control that, and how the rate of slavery became more vibrant also without a legal framework to guide that. So I'm wondering if public health programs, specifically like PEPFAR and the Prostitution Pledge and these legal regulations, quell the rate of the spread of the prostitution market, and how they affect the prices of prostitutions. So I wonder if you can compare places like Uganda who abide by these prostitution legal frameworks, and places like Brazil and Thailand, which don't, and how that affects the prices on the market, I guess, market of prostitution and the rate of spending.
Okay, please.
I was thinking about when you were talking about moving away from nation states and how that was kind of expanding the disparity between the middle class and the rich. I mean, I know that usually rich people, they have more expendable income, they can invest more, it's easier for them to make more money. But I was wondering your thoughts on like providing tariffs and protection on industries that are inefficient. So like I was wondering how you felt about maintaining a sort of middle class in part of the country where technically it shouldn't be maintained. I mean, if you looked at free market, and if we prolong that more and more and more and keep protecting those inefficiencies, do you think it'll be worse when that has to come to a close, or do you think there's going to be a smooth transition for those types of people to maintain?
Which countries do you refer to?
Specifically the United States. Okay. So like protecting farmers and manufacturing industries.
Okay. Can you address that question? Do you mind talking about taxable income brackets and how that might help? Never mind. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm going to add also one final one to this, because I think one of the interesting things about globalization is the migration. There are 100 million people moving around the globe. They're sending $300 billion around the globe. Some people are technically trafficked, or you can say enslaved. I mean, the vocabulary is different. Trafficked is going, you know, being moved against your will or being deceived. But then there are also people who are smuggled into parts of the world, the people who don't go legally, and they know what they're getting into, but they're willing to take that risk. Now, I don't really know if anybody knows the percentage out of these huge number of migrants, smuggled, trafficked, legal, et cetera. But I mean, this vast movement of people is also extraordinary, has an extraordinary impact on the global economy, and maybe you could just talk a little bit about that too, all in 10 minutes you have left.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, yeah, the political transition, how we're going to shape them. Well, I think, yes, of course, we can do it. But the problem is that the economy, as I said before, moves so fast. I know the transition of the former Soviet bloc because I work on that. Plus, you know, I did work at this Bank of Hungary before the whole thing happened. One of the things I noticed at that time, when there was the rush, there was literally a rush, it was like the gold rush, to the former communist country, is that the majority of the people I met who were sent from the United States and from other European countries to deal with it had never, ever studied anything about centrally planned economy. Zero. They had no idea. So, I mean... This was the mistake. We think that we can learn anything in no time at all, and we had a lot of expertise. We had a lot of people who actually had studied those economies, had lived in those countries, spoke the languages. I haven't seen any of those guys. So in the future, if we do want to do a transition, for example, in North Korea, I wouldn't get somebody from the Treasury simply because he's from the right party and he's in the right position. I would actually get somebody who has studied their economy, who knows how the economy works. So in that, I think we were extremely arrogant. And I will include people like Stiglitz among them, because now that he's writing all this book against globalization, he was right there. I remember him when he was saying, oh, yes, you know, let's do it. Let's export democracy. We can't export democracy. in a country that has never, ever known democracy, that has gone from an imperial Russia to a communist system. There was, as I said, that story, they had no treasury. Imagine an economy with no treasury. So that's just the tip of the iceberg. So that, so I think, you know, that's the way forward, is to use people that really know those economies. Now, the price of prostitution, well, the reason why the price of prostitute went down dramatically is because there was this massive influx from the Soviet bloc, of course, into Western Europe. From Western Europe, they went everywhere. We're one of the largest importers of prostitute coming from those areas is actually Israel. Even today, still, the borders of Israel, you find a lot of women coming from those areas. And the same thing is to the Far East. They were exported to the Far East. Those were high valuable merchandises, because these women were, number one, very beautiful, and apparently, you know, all men had these fantasies about these Slavic women. I don't know, I'm a woman, so I can't judge, but you probably can confirm it. Secondly, they were highly educated. So they were not the Asian. Until that time, the majority of prostitutes were traded in the West, in particular, were people coming from Southeast Asia, which were not highly educated. So there was an additional price on these women. I mean, I interviewed a lot of people that did this, traffickers, actually, of women, and they all said that men did not only want sex, they actually wanted a conversation, which is, yeah. So it is the type of merchandise. And there is that... also started to open up the market. It became culturally more acceptable to have sex with a prostitute, which had a certain kind of stigma until the late 1980s. And this is when the market for women coming from Africa, for example, was opened up. Until that time, you wouldn't find any of those. I'm talking about Western Europe, of course, but I'm sure the US is the same. So I think it's you have to look, unfortunately, at prostitution very much as a product, and you have to apply the same principle that you apply to any type of commodity. So this kind of like, you know, public health, for example, you know, this kind of regulation that you suggest, they do not work when you have a new product which is highly competitive on the market. It is true that legalization of prostitution has improved the condition of these women. For sure, yes, reduced sex slavery in Holland, for example, or also in West Germany. In Germany, prostitution is legal, while, of course, it's not legal in Great Britain. But the differences are minimal, to be honest, because it's a merchandise. Now, I didn't really understand exactly what you were referring about this middle class, maintaining the middle class. So you're saying that we protect our own farmers, for example, and with tariffs, and that is a strategy to maintain a certain income level in the middle class. That was what you say.
Maintaining their industry as a whole.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with that. But at the same time, if a state is not a market state, of course, then he has that responsibility. Now, in the transition from the nation state to a market state, you would expect for sure that these industries will be penalized because our industries that absorb money and do not produce money. But there is the other element of the market state, which is the element of any state, is the fact that these people vote. So in particular, for that example of farmers, you know, the Midwest, you know, the wheat belt of the Midwest, it is a backbone of American voters. These people actually vote. And in particular, this president has been looking at those votes. So the market state is also a state. So it is a state who trades favors in exchange for votes. So that's why. In that particular, there are, I can't think about any other sector that is protected in the same way that the farmers.
Just because you seem like you were getting at that moving away from the nation state was making the differences worse. So, but then I was wondering if you thought like it was making it worse by actually keeping that area of the population in kind of a nation state still like regulated.
Oh, that's what you mean. Yeah, yeah.
But,
well, I think for sure, because this is also part of the income redistribution. I mean, until recently, farmers were given money not to farm. So those were public money. This is money of your taxes. Now, today the situation is very different because with this surge in prices of commodities, those farmers will have to farm. And it'd be interesting to see what is going to happen. But yes, for sure, that is another element that distorts income redistribution. It is another element of the market state, whereby you exchange favors, economic favors, for votes. Yeah. 10 minutes, right?
Yep, you did. It's for my migration question. The easy one.
Yeah. Well, the migration question, this is the time in history where the largest number of people is moving. It is the great, I mean, should go down in history as the greatest migration. And the trafficking, I think to a certain extent the trafficking is also linked to the fact that we are trying, I mean, in the West, we're trying to protect our own borders. Having gone global, having taken all the advantages of globalization, we're now realizing that there is a problem in having these people coming in, because all we want from these people is to do certain kind of jobs that we don't want to do. And the best example is what's happened in France in the last few years with the riots. You know, outside Paris, those were riots started by second generation, so people born in Paris, and they were, the age group was from 17 to 22, 23. Those were kids of immigrants who had done certain kind of jobs, like, I don't know, sweeping the streets of Paris, cleaning houses, that kind of stuff. But those kids had been educated together with the French kids through the French system. So they did not want anymore to do the same kind of jobs. They wanted to move up the social ladder. And this is where we can't let them, because our economy has not grown sufficiently to absorb them. So I think this is one of the problems of globalization. That's why the British, for example, who have pushed so hard the European Union to let Romania and Bulgaria into the EU, are now denying entry to the Romanian and Bulgarians. So although these are part of the EU, they are not allowed to come in as the Polish did. So it is again another. I think it's again another aspect of rogue economics, because the economy is completely distorted by this phenomenon. But also, it's to a certain extent quite stupid from the government to again, because the government is not in control, to expect to let people in to do certain kind of job and maintain the future generation of those people at that level. That's not going to happen, not in a globalized world.
Right, okay, well, thank you very much, Lorda, and thanks so much for sharing your ideas with us. And I encourage everyone to buy Loretta's book. You can add it to your long collection of her books in your library. But thank you very much.
Thank you.